Will Wallen is the latest guest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Will is Director of Public Engagement in the Faculty of Humanities at the University of Kent. He's also an actor and he teaches actors, and we find out that he wasn't planning on being an academic. Now, he was born in Kent and grew up in Dorset, but he tells us about how his parents spent many years living in Kenya. We find out about studying at the University of Leeds. We discuss the perils of what happens when an actor falls ill. We learn about Will's earliest memories. We talk about why people go to the theatre in order to see people lose, and how comedy happens when people fall over. We find out about his first record-buying experience at the age of 10. We find out that he followed a different path to that of his peers by being into the Beatles, and how the music of the time passed him by. We talk about medleys of piano music and Bert Kampfert, and how he came to the University of Kent. We discuss teaching dynamics, how to engage with students, what happens when we don't always know our material, being a big Radio 4 listener, why Will is nostalgic about radio, why he values the BBC, why his memories are predominantly positive, why he has trained himself to listen to the gut and not just the head, and Will, at the end of the interview, gives an unexpected answer to the question of whether he considers himself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person. So join me. My name is Chris Deasy, and it's a great pleasure for this week's nostalgia interview to meet Will Wallen. Well, I'm with Will Wallen this afternoon, and it's great to meet you. I think this is the second time that we've met.
That's right, yeah.
And you're the Faculty of Humanities Director, or is it?
Public Engagement.
Public Engagement. I knew there was something communication or engagement in it, but wonderful to meet you. And you have a very different sort of journey, I think, to the one that some other colleagues have had in terms of you've been on the stage.
I have, yeah. In fact, I wasn't planning on being an academic at all. And if you told me 20 years ago I'd be teaching in a university, I don't know what I'd have done. I'd have laughed and then maybe cried, I don't know. I did a degree in French and philosophy at Leeds to start with, and then trained as an actor. And I worked as an actor then I still do the odd bit, but yeah, so that was, my career was as an actor, and then when my kids were born, I started directing more. I stopped touring, so directing was a way. I'd always done a bit of that as well, but it was a way of controlling a little bit more where I was at any one time. So I started directing. Yeah.
That is inspiring, though, because when I was young, if anybody had said to me, as indeed they did often, what do you want to do? I always wanted to do something in radio, but then did one degree, then another. And because by the time you, in my case, did a PhD, it's sort of, well, if you really want to do something in radio, why have you chosen a path where career options are narrow? But I'm at a point now in my mid-40s when I think, well, I'm not least through doing this podcast, I sort of am living that sort of a dream.
Yeah,
but actually what you said is quite inspiring, that it is possible to wear multiple hats.
Yeah, no, I've had to wear multiple hats on professionally. And actually it's been really interesting about how people don't necessarily like you wearing multiple hats. Or I hit upon when the internet sort of began being a thing where people could look people up on the internet and see what they were, right? I'd always been William Wallen as an actor. And then for some reason I was working at the Watermill Theatre in Berkshire, and everyone's always called me Will in conversation, but I'd always say I'm William Wallen for acting. And then someone just put my name on the poster as Will Wallen that was directing it. And I thought, oh, guru. And then I thought, oh, sod it, that's fine. And so all the directing then was, everything was Will apart from the acting, and it became really useful later on. So if people could Google William Wallen, they'd find all the acting stuff, and they wouldn't really know I was a director, which is problematic when you're looking for acting jobs. They don't want to see anything suggesting that you're anything else or things like that. So yeah, no, different hats, teaching and arts consultancy, and yeah, well, as an actor, you need other things to help you fill the gaps.
Yeah. Well, you just reminded me of the beginning of the film Tootsie, where, of course, the whole, you know, if you're an actor, really, unless you're cleaning dishes or serving in restaurants, then really there's no hope. Because, you know, the idea that you say, right, I'm going to be an actor and I'm going to be very, very rich.
Yeah, yeah. No, so it's great. So I did always teach a bit. So, you know, I'd go and teach usually other actors.
But you've touched on something about the academic profession, certainly where the expectation is, certainly when I did my PhD, the assumption was, oh, because you're doing this sort of research, you can teach. But the idea that because you're researching in an area that you can therefore command the attention of 40 students in a classroom, I mean, often, well, maybe the idea is that you can, but often now that we have things like PGCHEs, then it's possible to make that jump. But the number of hats I wear, senior tutor, I've done lots of work on module specs and programme specs in my role as it used to be called Director of Learning and Teaching. So, you know, being a good administrator and a teacher and a researcher. So in that sense, I suppose, doing things like podcasts or acting, you know, it's not actually, and obviously your background is drama, or, you know, it's your academic subject. It's not really maybe that big of a jump.
No, I don't think it is. Although, you know, so I've done lots of teaching and, you know, some actually in drama, there's lots of us, I think, who've had lots of different experiences with different age groups as well, because it tends to work that way. But definitely the fact that I've managed to entertain or, you know, keep 10-year-olds listening makes 19-year-olds a doddle. And definitely, and if you've done an assembly full of 110 year 9s and kind of kept them going, the students are a piece of cake. So it's good to have had that experience.
Because I always admire those students of mine who go on to do PGCEs, because of course they're not just teaching their subject. They may go into teaching because of a love of subject, but of course what they're soon going to find is that regardless of the content, unless you can control a class or discipline a class or earn the authority or respect of a class of 7-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 15-year-olds, whatever, then you're going to really struggle. And I feel so blessed where I am because I've only ever taught students over the age of 18, adults, who want to be here. In many cases, they particularly choose the modules that I'm teaching. So it's not so they're thinking, what is this guy talking about? So I think sometimes I've had it too easy.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I mean, and the easiest jobs I've had teaching have been teaching actors, actually, in drama schools. And certainly, sort of 10, 15 years ago, sometimes drama schools were fee-paying where universities weren't, and they weren't always... They'd made some quite significant sacrifices to get there, and they'd often had to persuade families that this was a good idea. So by the time they got in the classroom, teaching those students was amazing. It was wonderful. First of all, they'd auditioned as well. So you had the cream of the crop in the room, and it was like pushing a marble down a slope. It was really, you know, really straightforward.
But I was struck by what you were saying, that if, when you were, say, 15, you know, somebody said you'll be a university lecturer.
No,
what did you think?
That was very kind of you to think I was 15, 20 years ago.
No.
Yeah, that was really nice. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I'm obviously putting my own... Well, actually, I was 15... I can't remember, I was 30 years ago. I'm putting...
No.
But that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I assume that you're going to say that you wanted to be an actor. Or was that something that came later?
Although I think I wanted to be a writer. I think I quite fancied being a sort of turtleneck wearing writer, probably, you know, smoking Gauloises on the left bank, and, you know, probably, I don't know, I loved, you know, Beckett was, reading Samuel Beckett was what got me into theatre. So that was a slightly swotty thing to be doing, and probably rather pretentious thing to be doing aged 16. But I loved it, and I thought it was kind of hilarious and fun and profound. But then actually what I've discovered is I'm really temperamentally unsuited to writing anything at all. And when I have to, it's like getting blood out of a stone. It's not... I'm not a natural writer. I can write, but I don't want to. Nothing makes me want to sit down and do it at all. I've had to write plays and stuff like that, and the only thing that really pushes me on is a deadline.
Because it struck me a few years ago that, obviously, I have to write books as part of my job every few years, but I do a lot more writing, which is never seen because I've always kept a diary. And I write thousands, you know, sometimes, you know, well, sometimes a few thousand words a day. But of course, it's never going to be seen. And so there's, it's always that sense, like with an actor, I guess, that you see somebody's performance and you make all sorts of assumptions about the sort of person they are. And then you meet them. occasionally you think, well, this person doesn't seem very confident on stage or on film. They're hugely dynamic and charismatic. Mm. And you must have had experiences like that.
How do you mean, of meeting different
people?
Well,
yeah, I suppose meeting other people. I remember meeting one of, well, not an acting, but Martin Scorsese's long-term editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, who has Canterbury connections. And it's just, you know, and I wanted to talk about Scorsese, but the look in her eyes is much more, where are you going with this? And, you know, I think she felt a bit awkward, probably, asking all these questions.
And I think that stuff, I mean, some actors can turn it on all the time, but I mean, I think the thing is, basically, it takes quite a lot of energy. And, I mean, you couldn't function at that level of energy all the time.
Mm.
So when you're off, you're off. I remember kind of realising that I had to slightly alter the way I talked, just as I was just getting a little bit older.
Mm.
And I couldn't do, if I'd got three classes in the day, I couldn't do the class, because I'd push the students quite hard. But I couldn't do the class three times myself anymore.
Mm. I find my energy levels sort of go up. Sometimes at the beginning I think, oh, I've got 5 hours ahead of me, how am I going to do this? But, and even if I'm feeling a little bit under the weather, by the fifth hour I'm, you know, completely on a roll. And then a few hours later it really hits you, and I think that's the thing. So you're living off adrenaline, but of course I don't teach 24 hours a day, or, you know, I certainly don't teach 5 days a week. So I see where you're coming from with that. But I always remember thinking how someone like Robin Williams, you'd see him on chat shows, you think he's just like he is in film. He's completely frenetic, a ball of energy. But then, of course, whatever the reasons why he committed suicide, it's just interesting that you realise that sometimes the lives that people lead, that, you know, whether they, even if they're on a chat show rather than just on film, that you are still seeing their persona.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. Everyone needs their quiet moments, don't they?
And I always imagine that sometimes when you have these like sci-fi stars and they go around the convention circuit, and all the real geeks and the big fans will all sort of turn up there, and they're expecting the actor to be in role. And sometimes they'll play along with it, and other times it's like, do I really have to do another one of these? But again, it's
yeah, but the actors, it's part of their job.
I think it is, but I do often think what happens when. If you grow up, sometimes perhaps liking somebody's work better than the person who's doing it likes. It's like an old show that Chris Evans did on the telly in the 90s, where he had Cher on one of his programmes, and then he asked Cher various questions about her career, and he asked somebody from the audience who was like the biggest Cher fan, and the Cher fan knew more about Cher than Cher did. And I think that's very funny, but you step back and just think, well, sometimes if you invest too much of your energy into somebody else's life, then really the consequences are that, you know, you have no life.
Sure, absolutely.
Let's go back a bit further, because tell me a bit about where you were born, a little bit about where you grew up.
I was born in Kent, but didn't live there long. My parents had come across from Africa in 1969, so they'd left a newly independent Kenya or Kenya as it had been, and they had three small children, and I think there was a choice to be made. My dad had lived there basically all his life, from so he was born in 1930, and his dad had come over from the UK to Africa, I think, and bought a couple of fields of coffee and become quite a successful coffee farmer. But they left Africa. I think there was a choice whether to stay or to go, and I think it was quite uncertain what Kenya would become. And having three very small children, I think my dad, you know, made quite an adventurous but also maybe sensible, safe choice to bring them over here. So I was born in England, and all my sisters were born in Africa.
Yeah. And was your dad from Kenya originally, or did he travel there as part of work?
No, he was born there in 1930.
Yeah.
So he was born there, and his father had gone over and been the coffee farmer. And my mum went over after the war with her family, So she went over aged about 12, I think, something like that. And that was, yes, it was just an encouragement to go. People went, I think. So yeah. She met my dad out there,
yeah.
And they're still going. So they got married in 1956. So they've been married 62 years. Mm. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you been there yourself? Have you visited?
Never. And my dad's, it's quite interesting, my dad's never been back since 1969. He's just, I share that with him. I look back, but not in a way that makes me, I mean, I grew up in Dorset, having been born in Kent. My parents moved to Dorset, and my dad was a kind of country solicitor, doing, you know, bit of probate, bit of farming law, that sort of thing. And so, but then they left when I was 18 and went to university, and I was just trying to work out coming over here, because I knew this was about nostalgia. But actually, I've been back to the place where I lived when I was 18. I've been back once. I've no feeling of draw there at all. Mm. So maybe I have that in common with my dad. I think, and it wasn't. It's not because it was a bad time. It's a very nice, happy time. But my dad didn't. He's happy to remember it. How he lived there.
There is often a disconnect between space and place and time. You know, going back to universities, I mean, I found a few months ago that in meeting old university friends in a different place to where we used to go to university, 25 or more years on, was wonderful, because it was the connections, you know, it was the people we were connecting with. I've been back to the geographical place we went to university as well. And of course, you associate people with place, but also it's the place as it looked 25 years ago. And it's easy to sort of go around and think, oh, that looks very similar. Maybe it looks a little bit different. And of course, we change, buildings change. And I think actually sometimes you're right that sometimes going back can be counterproductive, because it's not something, you know, if we were going back and seeing the same people again in the same place doing the same things, that's one thing. But inevitably, even if you go back to a place like my old university town, in many ways looks very similar. It's a small Welsh town. A lot of the buildings seem not to have changed. They're properly preserved. But without the people there, or if the people are there, they've aged in that time, it really does play havoc with your sense of self.
It's an odd thing. I have been back to Leeds, where I went to university. And I've no pull there at all. And I think that's partly because some places have been really special. But Leeds, I think when I went there, I did French and philosophy. I don't know. I chose those subjects because I thought I enjoyed them. And I got there, and the French was a little bit disappointing, because there was lots of language, which was great. But Leeds was kind of very cleverly positioning itself as somewhere that really was training the next generation of Eurocrats, really. And that was great, but I just wanted to do poetry and French drama and that sort of thing, and sort of waddled about in the sort of late 19th, early 20th centuries of literature. And so there was a bit of that in my final year, and I had a great kind of year abroad. But, you know, yeah. But then I became an actor, and so everything I was working sort of towards in Leeds suddenly disappeared.
And how did you go into acting? Was that accidental, or was it just to make money? I think you touched on that.
Oh, yeah, no. Making money is a good... I mean, it's reputed to be not a very good way of making money, and I think it's not a very good way of assuring yourself a large amount of money. But, I mean, yeah. It's a perfectly good way of making a living, I found. And dare I say it, better than being an academic. But there's a stability that comes with being an academic that's also very appealing. It's very nice for me now to be doing that. But no, I got into acting because when I left school, I was a pretty good saxophonist, and I kind of thought, well, if I'm going to be an artist, that's probably what I did. And I got to university and I joined two societies, the Music Society and the Theatre Society. And I got into a show, and the Theatre Society was rehearsing every night, and the dance band was once a week, and it was. Yeah. So I did theatre, and that and I was up at Leeds at a time when there were some really good theatre makers who were still in the business, doing, you know, doing great stuff now. I think I was there at a really great time. There's lots of us actually out there in the business now.
And I'm guessing the percentage of people who can really, you know, make a real living out of it, or, you know, actually more, not just paying the bills, but actually is very, very small.
Well, maybe. I'm not sure.
I wouldn't know that.
I'm not sure. No, I think it's okay, because if you accept that in being an actor, you're probably going to be doing a mix of things. What's great about being a freelancer, it's tricky to start with. I think the first 5 years are tricky, but after that, if you're doing it well, if you're not doing it well, you'll stop, so it becomes irrelevant. And if you are doing it well, then actually you're in control of how much you're earning in a way that's quite interesting. I still find it a little bit odd. I've been employed because I ran a theatre for 5 years, and so obviously I was an employee there as the director of the theatre, but I found it really weird when I started doing that, thinking, well, I've worked more in March. Why haven't I earned more in March? Why have I just got the same amount? That just felt really odd. And getting paid when I was sort of on holiday felt really odd, because there was always that sense that there's a month in the summer that's actually a pretty lousy time for earning, but it's going to be okay in October.
And you hear that with radio presenters.
I'm sure.
Who will say, Ken Bruce comes to mind, who said effectively that when, you know, he's not always contracted with the BBC, but, you know, there have been times when if you're ill, for whatever reason, you don't get paid. Whereas in this profession, if, heaven forbid, I should ever not be able to deliver a lecture on a Friday morning, you know, it wouldn't suddenly mean that I'd have a dock in my pay. So in that sense, then again, you've got the other side of things. Tom Cruise once saying that, you know, he said, well, I'm not making a film at the moment, so technically I'm unemployed. And of course, that made me feel really depressed, because I thought, well, yeah, your definition of unemployed.
Well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, that's how it works. Yeah. And so, you know, I remember on the first day of my acting training, which was utterly life changing, a year that we had, and where I met my wife actually, but that first day, Adrian, who led the course, said, I mean, one of the things he said, among many of the other things, and there was no kind of beating around the bush, there was no flanneling, he just said, actors don't get ill, you don't get ill, because if you get ill. I mean, the thing is, A, yeah, that you might be legally have to be covered on here, but you won't work with that company again. Mm. And that's straightforward. So, and it, by and large, it's true. I've covered once for an actor who had pneumonia. But, you know, she was back in the show, you know, 24 hours later. So, you know, people...
I suppose it's like politicians who sometimes, you know, they don't always retire at the age of 65. You get, you know, well into their 70s sometimes. And of course, if you've been doing that all your life, then you're kitted out for that. You know, you're, I mean, I suppose it can be worse to stop. If you've been living a busy life and you just say, right, I've hit retirement age, I'm going to stop. Well, you know, that's probably not good, because your body, it's like, you know, if you've been running all your life and you stop running, well, there are going to be physical consequences, health consequences.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, and people can burn out and all of that sort of stuff. And I think the industry may be a little bit better about that sort of thing now. But actually, because there's no one has to employ anybody again. You know, why would you employ someone who was ill? There'll be somebody else who probably won't. You know, I mean, it's curious. You'd have to be very kind-hearted to do it, I think.
Yeah, I was having an interesting talk with one of our PhD students this morning, and we both reflected on the fact that in both our, because I taught her as an undergraduate, and she was never ill. She never missed a single class. She said the same when she was at school. And I thought, that's true here. I don't think I've ever, as a student, in the days when I was a student, we didn't even have attendance taken, but, you know, it was on your timetable. You know, where else are you going to be? If you're not in class, well, what are you doing? Instead, if you're doing something else, well, why can't you do that after class? So I think it's a mindset thing, because as senior tutor, I'm often dealing with those students who are not going to classes. Yeah. So it's just a different sort of way of approaching
things. And that's absolutely not, you know, not to undermine anyone who is actually ill.
Of course not.
You know, because that's kind of, you know, and then thank goodness when people do have jobs that allow them to do that.
Yeah, so it's a different sort of world.
Yeah.
But is there anything in particular that you remember from childhood? Any sort of earliest memories or anything?
I remember there were dogs, and there were there was a duck. I remember a duck nibbling my toe as a young sort of toddler. That's a very early kind of memory. I remember schools. I was always a pretty good boy at school, mainly, I think. I do remember, yeah, I went to a school, so I remember getting hit with a ruler at school, you know, which you do in that, there's definitely part of me that thinks, well, didn't do him any harm. And you know that I can look back on that with that was kind of okay. I don't. It's funny, you know.
According to the, because I'm assuming we're about the same sort of age, and that's exactly my experience. I remember once there must have been some children at primary school throwing stones in the road. I was in proximity to them. Maybe I threw a stone. I don't know. But all I remember is the head teacher, the person in the car must have stopped the car, come over to the school, demanded to see the head teacher, who then proceeded to effectively thrash everybody in sight because we were, you know, guilty before proven otherwise. But, you know, if that happened today, there would be severe consequences. And this was, what, late 70s, I would guess?
Late 70s. And did your head teacher get a kick out of thrashing people, do you think?
I think she used to...
Oh, it was a she.
And it was clearly an anger thing. And whether it was authentic anger or it was put on anger for the purposes of scaring the, you know, it was a primary school, so we were all under 11. I was in that school between the ages of 4 and 9. So, and she was close to retirement age at the time. Shocking. But that was always the fear, that the teacher would shout at you, that the teacher would be angry, and if you did that, then you've disappointed them, because you've got to face them every day. And maybe now, looking back, I think, well, you know, maybe that was just part of the act, the performance that they have to put on as a teacher. But for me, it was this worry of, you know, upsetting somebody or causing somebody to think badly of you. And that carries over you know, the consequences of when you're really young and you're impressionable. So, yeah, for me, the fear of being caned was actually enough to make me to be dutiful.
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I went to a kind of boys' prep school, which had recently taken on girls, and so that school, it emerges, was run by a paedophile, and I remember school very happily, and I remember him as quite a good maths teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, since when I've seen documentaries about this school that I know very well, where, you know, actually this is being held up as a sort of hell. And it must have been for some people, I guess.
Mm.
I don't know. So that's sort of funny kind of disjointedness between my own memories of a place, which are actually pretty positive. And I mean, it's funny, and now knowing what I know, it's quite... I find it hard... I have no particular desire to turn my memories into negative ones, which is quite interesting.
Mm. Because in keeping a diary, I guess I'm always, obviously aware that other people's apprehension of a particular day will be very different.
Sure.
But also it's my way of ensuring that, and it applies to seeing a film, that if I say at the time whether I liked it or not, obviously, often it's a bit more subtle than that. But it does matter, because there have been occasions when I've assumed that I've seen something and thought, oh, this is amazing, or the opposite. But then I might go back to the diary entry from the day that I saw it, when I realised that actually what I thought on the day didn't coincide with my subsequent memory of what I thought I'd seen on that day. And I think that's what's made me go from writing just a few lines, or even a few words 25 years ago in a diary, to now writing hundreds or thousands. Because for me, it's a case of almost to myself, in my dotage, I can say, yeah, that's as close as we can get to an authentic memory. That's what I was thinking. That's what I wrote at the time. Rather than, as you say, someone else saying, oh, it couldn't have been fun, or that was a really, you know, that wasn't the golden age. That was actually a really terrible time in the light of what we subsequently knew.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, it must have been terrible. And that was a school where I think the cane had recently been banned, or, you know, but now it was the slipper. And I remember that point at which, I think I was at that school, at the point at which corporal punishment was made I was outlawed. And I remember that there was an announcement, you know, at the school by the headmaster that, unfortunately, you know, I mean, you know, this was now illegal, and, you know, times had changed and whatever. But it was quite, yeah, so that was absolutely at the cusp. And my dad definitely has memories of being caned. Mm. Canes in front of the whole school. And what's hilarious is he used to hold it up as a kind of... He used to tell me that, you know, if I'd done something wrong, I had to own up. Mm. As, you know, and that mm. always seemed very reasonable. And then he'd tell a story about how one time at school he'd owned up and then had been caned in front of the whole school.
Mm.
And this was sort of meant to encourage me to own up. And it was kind of part of that whole kind of... This was about being a man somehow, and you know, being honest.
Well, you just made me think, when the national this is so incongruous. But when the national lottery was introduced in 1994, there was a Conservative MP at the time, I believe, who said that what we should be doing on the lottery programme, because it has a large audience, is flog criminals, as in, you know, they should be publicly humiliated on the national lottery programme, as in, but that's what everybody is watching. Therefore, that's the place to name and shame in the current day, rather than in the marketplace or in the town square. We'll do it on national television before drawing those lottery numbers. But you can see the logic there, even if it's absurd.
Yeah. No, I mean, I always tell my students that we fundamentally go to the theatre to see people lose, and I think that's true, and if that doesn't happen, I think we've probably had a fairly boring night out.
Mm.
You know. It's not about the person who wins. If no one loses, then it's certainly not funny, and it's certainly not moving. You know, that we have to lose in order to win. I mean, fighting comedy happens when people fall over or they lose, or so there's something about that, because very often we're teaching actors how to you know, they want to win. You know, they're trying to get something. That's what they're doing, that character. But actually, the person who manages to lose in that transaction is really important.
Yeah, because if you're listening to a radio presenter and they're constantly cheery and happy, there's a sense in which you feel, well, this... You feel that there's... Well, you're thinking, well, is there something that is being deliberately offset here? Are they concealing something? If they're doing that, I can't really warm to them. I'm listening to somebody who's putting on an act, or you know, and that's interesting. What am I craving? Am I listening to the radio program for the music, or am I trying to have a relationship with the presenter? But in the same way, when you go to see like a film, I saw the original Halloween just the other night, 40 years on, and it's true that you're going there, you're witnessing somebody suffering. But then I haven't obviously seen the new Halloween film, but when that comes out, that's all about this notion of trauma. Something happened 40 years ago and you're reliving that and so on. And that's really interesting about why we're going out. We're not going out necessarily for escapism. I talk about this with my students, because if it was escapist, then some of the films we go to see where there's vicarious suffering, that doesn't seem very escapist to me. But there is something there about almost maybe the characters on the screen are suffering so we don't have to.
Yeah, there's something about that, and there's something about something, I mean, something sorts itself out in our heads. And I don't, you know, I'm not a scholar in this area, but there's something that I think when we see something that, you know, we talk, you know, obviously with the ancient Greeks talked about catharsis, but there's something that happens in our heads that changes from before and after. I think that is kind of good for us.
Yeah. Because one of the things when I was growing up that I was obsessed with were the charts, with music. What was, in a way that probably doesn't happen now because you can download anything, then it was the case of you either caught it on the radio or you bought it from Woolworths.
Yeah.
And so growing up in school, you know, our identities were formed largely by our musical preferences. What about in your case?
Okay, so I took a very... so this was the 80s, right? So I was at... So my first record buying experiences were... I suppose I'd have been about 10, so I'm nearly 44 now. So I was 84, and I utterly rejected. I was given a Walkman, aged about 10. That was pretty good, and I was given a tape, which, to be honest, I mean, it had Paul Young on it, and it had sort of 99 Red Balloons and that sort of. So it was that kind of
very 84.
Yeah, absolutely, that kind of thing. And then, which wasn't my thing, but I had discovered old singles from my sister's collections. Now they were because they were much older than me. So by the time I was 10, my younger sister was 22 and no longer in the house. And so they were. So I'd play that, and I was much more interested in these singles from the early 70s and 60s. So I became a complete Beatles nut in the mid 80s, which wasn't desperately fashionable. There was no one kind of. I had a pair of bright yellow corduroy 1970s flares as well that I'd found in a second-hand shop that were just so not what you should be wearing around. I had a sort of flower power waistcoats and that sort of thing. I thought all of that sort of stuff was great, and I was absolutely the 80s musically passed me by almost entirely, and I started getting into contemporary music more when bands like Supergrass came along as a student, but they were sounding a bit like those sort of modish 60s kind of, you know, bands. But I loved that, and absolutely so people liked, so my first albums were Beatles and the CDs came out, and you know, it's Velvet Underground and Nico and all of that kind of, and Donovan, it was all that kind of hippie stuff. Mm-hmm. I loved all of that.
Yeah, I think we all have those parallel identities, often from our parents, because the music that our parents grew up to, you know, my dad had vinyl, and so I would listen to his vinyl. So I'd be, you know, I might go from, I know, Shaking Stevens to Lonnie Donegan or Bucks Fizz to Buddy Holly. Yeah. It's incongruous.
So I reckon that listening to you, I reckon my dad is, because I've got these older sisters, my dad's a generation, if you like, before your dad.
Yeah, there's 10 or 11 years.
He's pre-rock and roll. My dad didn't really... Rock and roll didn't come into it. So he quite liked the Andrews sisters. And there's this... I don't know if you've ever heard of Charlie Kuntz, but Charlie Kuntz used to play medleys of piano music. I mean, that's all he did. So this is proper kind of 78... kind of stuff, and he quite liked that kind of thing. My mum was a bit more groovy, a bit more easy, you know, so she liked the easy listening sort of Herb Alpert kind of stuff, you know, the Burt Bacharach, and you know, I mean Burt Kampfert, Swinging Safari, you know, all that kind of you know, that kind of stuff, you know, Herb Alpert and
I listened to all that because I used to record stuff from the radio, and I've still got the tapes. I digitized them a few years ago, and on a roll, I've got about 90 hours of stuff that goes from 1991 to 2005, and it's all almost without exception Radio 2. Radio 2 was very different in the early 90s to what it was later on. So all that sort of music that you mentioned, Tijuana Brass, was there in abundance.
So you were listening to Radio 2? Well,
when I was at university. Okay, and actually, this very evening, because by the time this goes out, it'll have passed, I'm going to go, to the cinema to see Cliff Richard on his sixth anniversary tour. On the grounds that Cliff Richard, irrespective of whatever one liked, it's irrelevant because he was around when my parents were growing up. Yeah. He was around when I was growing up, all the Christmas number ones and so on. So, you know, I feel completely fused with this. You know, I can't wired for sound. I was, you know, well, we on the skateboard.
We definitely had an LP of Summer Holiday, and that was definitely one of the records that I loved it. Mm. You know, as a sort of 8 year old, something like that. And I don't know if it was my mum's. I think it's or one of my sisters. You know, it might have been one of my sisters who might have been into sort of the Osmonds and, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah.
Mm. No, well, and it just goes to show then, and also I've interviewed people who have grown up in completely other parts of the world, and ABBA is often like a link. This, you know, growing up in India or growing up in, you know, either of boy or girl bands, you know, you wouldn't expect necessarily to be part of the culture, but no, it has this universal sort of motif. Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah, you mentioned the Osmonds.
Well, I don't know much about. I mean, that completely passed me by. I wasn't interested in that at all. But I'm wondering who had the Cliff Richard album, and I wonder if it, you know. And I certainly, I'd have tried out those Osmond things, and no, it was a bit kind of. But then there was, you know, things like Jack Wilde, and do you remember that the guy who played the Artful Dodger in the Oliver film?
Oh yeah,
had a little mini pop career. You know, Wait for the Summer and I mean it's kind of saccharine around the same sort of time as Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree, that kind of just an abominable time in music,
it
really
was,
but there's something, but there was, it was also something slightly new, and actually linking telly to music, and there's linking to sort of that link is being made, that people are making the transition from being the Artful Dodger in the movie, and suddenly there can be a teenage. So there's this teenage heartthrob thing, I suppose, going on. That sort of Jack Wilde thing, and Osmonds, and.
But the crossovers were huge, especially, you know, Saturday morning television. You know, you'd have all, you know, and people would be queuing outside the studio because it was live TV in those days. And of course, if I think there was actually on in my generation, really, it was Christmas morning, would have been 1988, and Bros were being interviewed on the Radio 1 Breakfast Show. But then they had to point out, not least, of course, because there's no public transport on Christmas Day, that this was a pre-recorded interview. Could you imagine people, you know, abandoning Christmas, escaping Christmas, in order to go to see their favourite pop stars, and they're not really there?
No.
The question I would normally ask at this point would be, what inspired you to enter academia? But of course, we've already covered all of that, and that wasn't... Well, I suppose it is relevant to ask that question, because you obviously then returned to it. Because obviously you did a degree, you were a student, you were an actor, but how did you end up then not quite leaving the stage, because obviously you still do acting and work and directing work, but how did you end up working at the University
of Kent? So let's not say end up to start with. You know, it's all, this is a journey.
A journey which has journey. No end.
Yeah, so, and in a way that's part of, I don't see it as this is what I do or this is who I am. So who knows what I'm, you know, might be doing in 10 years' time. And I like that. I think as an actor, I got used to applying for jobs. I like applying for jobs. One of my roles is lead for employability in arts, and I think I'm quite good at that. Partly because I think I've probably applied for more jobs than many of my colleagues. I'm guessing, and I like that. I like the hunt. I like the competitive thing about all of that. So yes, getting the academia was really partly a I stopped running the theatre in Margate in 2012, so I ran the Theatre Royal Margate for 5 years, and then I did some arts consultancy, and I just when I was at the Watermill Theatre in Newbury, where I'd been a kind of staff director and helping run the outreach department, they'd been I'd had a day a week teaching and acting training, and I just gave Ollie Double, I think, a ring here and just said, if there's ever any teaching a day a week, that would be really cool, because all my freelance work was in London and I was still living down here, and I just kind of thought that would be nice, and it was, and it was much nicer than I thought it even would be. And then a job came up and I just kind of thought, well, I really like doing this. And I'd always thought, if I'm teaching, who am I to teach if I'm not doing it? And so I'd never wanted to. If I'm teaching actors, if I'm teaching people about this, if I'm not doing it, then what right have I got to teach that? And now I'm kind of thinking, well, actually, I've done it for 20 years. I do have that right now. But before that, I'd absolutely not felt that at all.
And teaching always, to me, feels reciprocal, in the sense that although we are teaching the students and we're grading their work, it works both ways, because the students assess us, they fill in surveys, the NSS survey, and of course module feedback forms, and also on a day-to-day basis.
I suppose I'm not remotely interested in what they think of me. I mean that absolutely sincerely. And I think, I hope that will result in them feeling that it's okay. But it's interesting that.
But you do know, don't you? Because whether the students turn up, whether they complain, whether they seem apathetic, whether they are inspired by you. You know, you're bound to pick up on
it's
it. Or colleagues will pick up on it.
It's true that, and I think there's something about there's one, you know, there's lessons I have from theatre, and I feel really strongly about this. That, you know, that our principal job is to teach, and the theatre, I'd have them as a director, I'd have this mantra, you know, in my head that, you know, that it's never the audience's fault. It's never the audience's fault. So if the audience is bored, that is not their fault. That is your fault. You know, that is our fault as actors or directors. We've got something wrong here. And if one lot loved it and the next lot didn't like it, that's not their fault either. It's because we weren't talking to them, or we, you know, there was something. So I mean, I love that challenge, but I also, particularly with the stuff I do with acting, which is less a kind of subject and much more about, I'm really lucky. I get to, well, it's not lucky. I suppose I get to do, they've hired me to do the stuff I'm good at, but it's about dealing with 20 different people in the room. And so, I mean, I can tell them this is how it is, but actually what's interesting is how it is for you. And teaching this student is going to be different to teaching the other student, because they'll have different things in the way of going where they need to go. So that's really stimulating for me.
Yeah, it always keeps me on my feet, because even if you're teaching the same module year in, year out, it's never the same, different seminar groups. Right, yeah. And I used to find even the time of day. I could never work out why teaching on a Tuesday from 4 till 6, something didn't click with the students, but I'd be in at 9 o'clock the next morning. And every week, it was always the same pattern. The Tuesday, something wasn't right. The Wednesday, it was. And I could never quite figure out why that was. But it was. There's lots of different dynamics going on. And I think, and I suppose gradually over time, there are modules that I wasn't completely comfortable delivering then that I am now. And somehow, gradually, I cracked it. I worked out why, what I was doing, why I was more relaxed in some. Ironically, if I was teaching on something that is my research area, I was far more defensive than if it wasn't my area, in which case I didn't, you know, it was more a case of nothing to lose. So it's things like that.
Because when students were questioning you or whatever, and in a way that's partly about not being quite sure yourself of where it is. I mean, absolutely. So that experience of I remember when I first started being asked to do a lecture, you know, I'm not going to say what it was, but it was a lecture on two figures in theatre, and one of whom I know quite a lot about and the other one less so. And it was just one of those lectures that had to be done to the first years because it was on the syllabus and somebody else had always done it and they're not here anymore or whatever. So I was given their old lecture slides and I kind of looked through them. I thought, I better learn, you know, I better go and learn about this other person. And I did. But there was a kind of horrible moment when my slides sort of broke down and you know, the projector just went... And now I'm kind of... You know, had it broken down in the middle of the one that I really know my stuff on, that would have been fine. But it was just suddenly the realization that without my slides, where I'd written what I needed to say, I was kind of lost here. But so I gave them something to do, and we fixed the projector. But it was just, that was quite interesting. And the expectation that I think it's quite often you feel the expectation that these students need you to know everything, and it's quite a release when you don't. But I do find when I'm teaching on a subject area which I am very lucky I do now, I've got I've got modules that I've designed, and when you know your shit, it's great.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you're firing on all cylinders, and they can see the difference. That's when you see that third year student essay that's coming through, and suddenly you get the sense, what's great about this is not so much how brilliant the writing is, but here's someone who knows their shit, and they're writing about something that they've been interested in all along, and have had this development and. And that often, you know, that's great when that happens.
And in one case, a student who was very quiet in the class, didn't say very much, she did subsequently do a master's with us, but she wrote an essay in which she corroborated a point made about how a particular theologian is no longer in vogue by referring, and she did it, actually, it was done in a very professional way, but the way the teaching on that particular topic had gone, she'd observed the fact that the students just weren't interested in that, unlike other topics. And she did it in such a way that, you know, it wasn't like, oh, you know, she's run out of things to say, she's going to start deconstructing my lecture. But no, but it was completely spot on. And I've felt the same thing as well, that in previous years it was on myth, and it was on the problem with myth, dealing with somebody called Rudolf Bultmann. And somehow a few years earlier, people were getting really stuck into it. But I asked the students some years later, why is this not connecting? And I think the argument was, well, we watch Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings and Star Wars, so this guy from 50 years ago is telling us about how we don't believe in myth anymore in our technological scientific age. We said, we don't understand that. So, of course, I'm looking at what somebody was saying half a century ago, and then from the point of view of today, the students are like, this is not a problem for us. We're looking at a problem historically, and they weren't connecting with it. And yet I did my undergraduate dissertation in 1994 on that very topic, and it seemed at the time somehow the most contemporary, the most alive of subjects. I don't know why.
I think that's definitely in drama. We have similar things. So, you know, when I was at university, and I didn't do drama, I spent most of my time hanging around the drama department. But they were doing Howard Barker and Stephen Burkoff and all these kind of. And actually, what's interesting, coming back into an academic drama department, those are two names I haven't heard mentioned at all. And it's just, it's a vogue thing. It's a kind of who we care about. And I'm just sort of realising that the things I care about aren't the things the students care about that much either. You know?
Yeah.
And that's okay. Yeah. That's okay.
But we'll go to some more sort of philosophically based questions in a minute. But when you were at university, what about things like politics or religion or sport? You know, were there other things going on in the background that you particularly hooked into? Or
I joined the Student Labour Party. And I joined in time to vote in the leadership election that elected Tony Blair. So,
I joined the Labour Party at that very time.
So,
and subsequently left.
There you are. Well, I've subsequently left. I'm a joined up Liberal Democrat now. That's where I am. Absolutely. I don't think I could ever go back to the Labour Party, but actually, there's all that Iraq war and stuff like that, which is absolutely part of why I don't think I can go back. But there was the thing that really, that was the end of my relationship with the Labour Party. It made me realise that fundamentally, I'm a liberal at heart. Was the banning of beef on the bone that just made me so furious. That was it. I just kind of thought, what are you doing? This isn't government business. By all means, tell us it might be dangerous, but let me have my beef, thank you very much, or whatever.
Yeah, the straw that broke the camel's back for me was actually what happened in the Welsh Assembly.
Okay.
Because Ron Davies was going to be the First Minister, he resigned, and the obvious successor, the guy who wanted the job before and came close to getting it, was Roderick Morgan. And Tony Blair didn't want him, and they tried Alan Michael to take the job. So this is obviously a niche area for people listening to this. But for me, it was like, we're going to give you devolution, but we'll give it to you on our terms. We're going to, and Donald Dewar was Blair's choice, he was First Minister, he can be the first, he was the Secretary of State for Scotland, now he can be First Minister. Last minute, Alan Michael became Secretary of State, and they were saying, oh, well, we need continuity. It's like, no, he's been doing that job for 2 minutes, never expressed an interest in devolution. Yeah. Roderick Morgan was hankering for the job, because in the end he did get it, but that was, through nobody could have known. For me, I was so outraged. It was like, devolution, but we'll tell you who you're going to vote for. I thought, no, that's I don't want. I wasn't paying very much to the party.
Because the world we all live in now, that's affected so much of our lives and how businesses are run, universities are run, and that kind of, we're constantly putting out a spin message and a. It's part of our culture. I do remember. I mean, what that means is that I was at university in 1997 when Blair got in, and that was a very exciting time. And I couldn't remember a time pre 2000. Tory government.
Yeah.
So that was that felt, yeah, same that felt here. Very exciting.
Yeah. There's a photograph of me on the steps of Downing Street when I was 5, and that's when Jim Callaghan was Prime Minister. But I don't remember it, but there is the, because these days you wouldn't get anywhere near.
What were you doing on the steps of Downing Street?
Well, in those days, you could just walk up. It was a trip to London. And you could...
Oh, I see. Yeah. You hadn't been invited for tea.
No. Unfortunately, no golden sort of, pass. No, I literally was the case. But you could just walk up.
Those gates were there.
Those gates were when you put in, and Thatcher's time. But, yeah, and so, having a photograph outside number 10 was sort of quite a normal thing to do on a day trip to London.
Yeah, that's right.
Unthinkable today.
Yeah.
What about listening to the radio? Was that something that played a big role?
What then or now?
Well, both. But there's obviously continuity.
Or university, definitely. And I've always been a big Radio 4 listener. Mm. And now I get... It's Radio 4, or if I've heard it before, it flips to Radio 3. And there's... I know there's a sort of vague nostalgia theme to all of these ideas. So I am nostalgic for it. And what I love about the radio, and what I think I won't really ever get about podcasts, actually, for me personally, is I love someone telling me what I'm going to listen to. And I love that. I miss that with television. Because I know it's kind of possible, but it doesn't really happen now. I go home and I will, watch things on iPlayer or playback. Occasionally there'll be something on the schedule, but I love that sense of being told something and hearing something that I might not have heard. And then if it's not Radio 4, I flip it to Radio 3.
And for me, it has to be live for it to be listenable. Obviously, I'm doing this podcast, but I'm treating it as a radio program.
Yeah, I get that.
And for me, absolutely. I have to, a confession, I don't really listen to other podcasts.
No.
For me, radio is my love. And so this is the podcast as radio.
Yeah. I completely get that. I love that talking radio. I'm not, occasionally I'll put on a Radio 1 or 2. Yeah. But... nearly never. Radio 1, just no.
Yeah.
That's left me far behind. And, there's part of me that, yes, absolutely believes in the BBC. I can't listen to commercial radio, really. I can't bear the adverts.
Yeah. I made the migration probably around the time I went to university from Radio 1 to Radio 2. And, of course, in a few short years, the same presenters. Think of all the Radio 2 breakfast show presenters. They've all, you think now of... Obviously, Zoe Ball is going to take on the job. Chris Evans before, but think of all Mark Goodyear. They've all done the Radio 1 Breakfast Show. Simon Mayo,
yeah. Well, I do remember. That's right. So I must have listened to a bit of Radio 1 at university, but I think that would have been somebody else putting it on.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been me.
In that sense, my tastes are a little bit less highbrow.
Well, I don't know that it's highbrow.
Well, Radio 4, Radio 3.
Yeah, no, but I love it. What's funny is that I'm an actor, but I think some of the plays on Radio 4 are abominable sometimes, and the comedy. Sometimes it's great, though, and I love it when that happens, and I like the talking and the analysis, and just that sense of hearing something I might never... Things like, Farming Today. If I can wake up in the morning on a Saturday, if I've forgotten to turn my alarm off and I catch the Farming programme or Rambling in the morning with Claire Balding or whatever, and I'm off in the countryside, I love that.
I do think, though, that obviously Brexit is, 29th of, if it happens, March 2019.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, but if the BBC were to get rid of the shipping forecast or... Farming Today, I wonder if there'd be more riots in the streets.
Well, maybe.
No, because it's a serious point. When Radio 3 and 4 particularly have changed their schedules over the years, the backlash, the BBC have had to renege on certain programmes. Was it Front Row? I'm not sure. Where they they wanted to get rid of them. But
there was Thought enough... of the Day they've had a go. I love all of that. Mm. It's all part of the fabric of...
Mm.
And when I'm in the car, I listen to the radio, and I got it. I even got into the Archers. That was just because of my son was. That was the time when he'd be being breastfed by my wife, and then I'd be making supper on my own, and so I'd find myself on my own in the house at this point, of the evening, and on it, and so Home of the Archers, and yeah, but now I can tune in. You know, I don't have to rush to the car and sit in when it's Archers.
No, but and all those songs that I listen to in the car, these 90 hours of stuff that spent all those years, I'm still taking it back to those original times when those recordings were made.
Yeah.
A few more philosophical questions to finish off. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive? I know that's a very wide, sweeping question, but
I think I would, and I think that's it's part of how you build your now, isn't it? That the so I think I do have memories which aren't positive, and you know, maybe more painful memories, things. But then I don't feel that they're, I think I've dealt with them. I don't think I'm sort of blocking them out. But I'd find it, positive places are easier places to go. Maybe it's that. Mm. They're easier to go. I mean, why would I want to go back somewhere that's very painful? Because that would take an effort. So just as if you're an actor, to go somewhere that's emotionally demanding, which, you know, absolutely is you can do, and it's good exercise, and that's fun, and I feel I'm quite emotionally fit in that way, and if I need to, just for those kind of things, that's fine. But no, positive.
Because I always feel it's that reinterpretation, that reframing of the past, whereby, as we were saying earlier, you remember events through a particular lens. It can work both ways.
Yeah.
And for me, there is this innate sense, and I don't know where it comes from, for this sort of authentic, this is what really happened, that's how I felt, rather than how I think I may have felt because somebody has told me otherwise, or somebody said, oh, you couldn't possibly have enjoyed being in a certain place at a certain time because it was so corrupt, or it was so miserable, or it always rained. And so that whole sense about, you know, whether you can be nostalgic about negative or debilitating experiences, I find really interesting.
I think because you can change them. So there's something about that. So if I think of really difficult times, and I'm not even dealing with it. But so things I find. So when I ran a theatre, I was managing people, and I find managing people fairly straightforward when it's all fine. That seems that's obvious, but when it's not fine, I find that really difficult. I find people and people's if people are being in some way disloyal or dishonest. And there, and you, and then you've got to. I don't know. So I've had a couple of experiences where I've had to be, you know, disciplining somebody, and I find that personally difficult. Although in the end, I've done what I've needed to do. But in reframing the memory, so that at the time might have given me quite a sleepless night about. But in reframing it, I can just say, this is what I did.
Mm.
And that's okay, because I don't want to sleep this night again.
It's also what comes out of it, because something can be a terrible thing to go through, but you can say, at the time, it may not have been obvious, and this happens in relationships.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can say, actually, it was and worth it in the end, and here we are.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that context, it's not so debilitating after all.
Mm.
But it's when those things are not resolved, and sometimes you know you're still and it can be a trauma of it might be a relationship, but something
where
you sort of feel I don't know where this was going, and I don't know what there was to learn from that. I don't know, you know, what I have to do differently, or you know, how did I find myself in the situation? I think that's the problem, and for me, I find it really hard to get over. You know, people say, oh, move on sometimes, and you think, well, that's an interesting thing to say, because moving on, I don't want to move on, I want to sort it out.
Mm.
It's like a jigsaw. It's like, well, you know, once you've started on it, or a thesis, you can't, until you actually finish it, it feels that it's incomplete, and you know that there will be consequences, which is you haven't learned the lessons, you haven't finished that game, so you're starting another one when you're not ready for it.
Yes. It's, I think sometimes there's relief there when you can move on, or when you can... when you know you've done something that feels like the right thing to have done, and then you know, and that I remember agonies about whether I'd take a particular job or not, and as soon as I said no, it was just great, because you know, every bone in my body was saying you should take this. Well, you should take this because this is what you should, and I just didn't want to. And then actually saying no, brilliant, you know. So that was quite a good lesson.
Yeah.
Sometimes listening to the gut as well as the head.
What about the question of whether you feel that you have fulfilled all the dreams you had when you were young? It's an interesting question in your case, because it's clear that you never expected to be working where you are now.
Yeah.
And of course, you have already indicated yourself, who knows in 10 or 20 years' time where you might be. But I think it's that sense of a continuum, which I find, certainly when I meet friends that I haven't seen in 20-odd years, you know, we all have dreams, maybe, but it says something about who we are and whether we are the same person, our sense of identity, our sense of self. And do you feel in your case that there's still more to do or different things, or have you found your
I find myself... I don't know that I found my niche. I think I like doing things that are... Yeah, so I don't kind of feel this is an arrival point. I don't. But having said that, I happen to have run a theatre. That's something I wanted to do for ages. So, and I've done that. And what's interesting is, having done it, I kind of think, oh, I'd quite like to do that again. But I've absolutely no burning desire to do it again. And if I didn't do it again, that would be absolutely fine. So I've done that. I'm happily married. That's very nice. I've got two kids. They are brilliant. So in terms of hopes for the future, I think a lot of it for me is tied up with being a dad and hoping that they're going to be all right, hoping that that's going to be okay. Yes, hoping that I'll be healthy enough to see them do whatever they want to do, and hoping that they'll think things are okay. And yeah.
And in that sense, get a steer from you, or sort of see you as somebody who has trodden a particular path, and that can be an inspiration. They may take a different path, but it's that sense of, okay, well, you know, and it can be the safety thing, a sort of like, well, you know, you can. Some people will enter profession, stay there forever. Other people finding their feet. But either way, the children can say it's going to be okay, because we kind of feel that we've got the support, and we know that taking risks sometimes can produce good dividends.
Well, they will have the support, and they've seen us take risks, and I think I'm naturally quite a risk taker. Not in a body and soul kind of way, but I don't think they'll do the same thing as me at all. I don't think they'll be remotely, you know, the last thing they'd want to be is an artist. Yeah.
It is funny that one of my daughters is very good at maths, and I never was, and it's just really funny to see dancing and another. It's just very odd. It's like, well, that really wasn't.
I think my sons will be much more, in a way, conservative. I think so, but not. I don't mean in a kind of playing it safe kind of way. But I think there's a slight crisis in the liberal, you know, the my generation liberal thinkers, that I think there are some, it leaves us with some problems about boundaries and that sort of thing. And it's quite interesting, I see my sons just say, well, why would you want that? You know, isn't that... And so I find that quite interesting, and I hope that they will... You know, I think they're pretty sensible, they'll find some moderation. But I'm quite interested, because I remember kicking back against my much more conservative father. He said, great, you know, bring it on, that's all right. You know, it's great that you've got...
And it's quite funny then when... That's right, and from the opposite direction as well. In that sense, that the children can say, you know, so you were rebelling against one thing or reacting against something, and then your children will go the opposite way to you.
I had the long hair, and you know, kind of, and you know, and my sons are pretty snappy dressers, really.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it?
And it's great.
Yeah, but that is also great, because it's them. That's who they want to be. Absolutely.
Completely.
Yeah. Final question: would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Looking forward, but actually, I think I think this is true of a lot of actors. Actually, there's a kind of professional deformity, if you like, of us to be pretty much in the present. And that's, I think that's where our training puts us, that fundamentally where I need to be is here, and no one is going to watch me if I'm thinking about what I had for lunch yesterday, what I'm going to do now. I've got to be acting now. So I think those muscles of being here now are quite well attuned. So I think if anything, forward, but actually it's there, I'll eat it.
Well, it has been so wonderful to catch up with you today. Thank you very much.
It's been fun. Thank you.
Fantastic. Cheers. Thank you.